want to begin this evening by reading first from Daniel chapter 2. And just the last few verses, verses 46 to 49. Daniel 2, 46 to 49. Perhaps I could just say before I read, where Phil's gone. Oh, you're there, Phil. Thanks for welcoming me. It's always, for me, it's always a great delight, the Presbytery Conference. It's great to see the beloved faces of brothers and just to have time of fellowship in the Word of God. And this paper, I'm not sure what the title should be, really. I've struggled with the title and I've struggled with the content, so don't expect too much. Think of it as a very basic Bible study. And just think of the subject as the exile and return. We're in that period in the history of God's people, the exile and return. And I'll explain a bit more about what I'm going to do in a minute. But let's look at these verses in Daniel chapter 2, verse 46. They're actually remarkable verses. I don't know if they'll strike you as they should. Then King Nebuchadnezzar fell on his face, prostrate before Daniel. And if that's not breathtaking enough, it goes on. And commanded that they should present an offering and incense to him. The king answered Daniel and said, "Truly, your God is the God of gods, the Lord of lords, and a revealer of secrets, since you could reveal this secret." Then the king promoted Daniel and gave him many great gifts, and he made him ruler over the whole province of Babylon and chief administrator over all the wise men of Babylon. And Daniel petitioned the king, and he set Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego over the affairs of the province of Babylon. But Daniel sat in the gate of the king. There are several lines in that reading which are quite striking. First of all, you have the picture of Nebuchadnezzar prostrate before Daniel. We'll come back to that. But also, you notice at the end for now, he sat in the gate of the king. And I'll come back in a minute. I'll explain why I wanted to refer to that. Now, you should have picked up, if you want them, there are five handouts, and I'll explain them as they become relevant. So let's first of all think about what my aims are. My aims are quite modest this evening. I want to try to sketch for you, it's just a sketch, how the lives of certain men, certain of God's servants, were interwoven. There are connections between the lives of the servants of God that we know. So my aim is to just paint, sketch those connections. A second aim I have is to encourage you to preach from the books that come from this period of the history of the people of God. There's an immense wealth in the books that are connected with the exile and the return. And I want to arm you with some information about those books so that to save your work, if you're a preacher, what's on the handouts, if you keep it, it will save you digging through commentaries and other books because it's there in a neat form. So it will save you work if you use it. Okay, so first of all, my introduction. The period of time is from the reign of Josiah. We're thinking about the time from the reign of Josiah to the time of Nehemiah. That's the period. Roughly, almost exactly, from the year 640 to 440. So we're in that period, 640 BC to 440 BC, from the reign of Josiah to the time of Nehemiah. That's the period. And that covers the last years of the kingdom of Judah. The last years of the kingdom of Judah. It covers the exile in Babylon and the return. But not just the return, but also, not only some came back, But you also have the diaspora, the dispersion of God's people. So we're in that period, we're looking at what was happening just before they went into exile, when they went into exile, and when they came back, okay? That's the first, that's the period. And then secondly, I mentioned the books of the Old Testament that are connected with this period. And I don't know how many you can think of offhand, but listen, Zephaniah is from this period. Jeremiah is from this period. Ezekiel is from this period. Haggai, Zechariah, and Malachi. That's six prophets. You have the end of Two Kings, the end of Two Chronicles. You have Ezra, Nehemiah, Esther. You have Daniel. And then you have a psalm like Psalm 137 and the Book of Lamentations. It's about a third of the Old Testament is in this period, comes from this period. And so what I'm hoping to give you is something that will help you in your reading of these books. So the period is 640 to 440. The books are all of those. And then a little note about chronology. When you study this period, some of the dates that we talk about are absolutely exact. We know the very day that things happened. And other dates are vague and we're not sure. So the dates of different reliability. Now, just a word, the first two handouts are black and white, but they look something like that. And it's about the calendar, and I'm just going to comment on this and pass over it. The point is this. In Judah, they had a calendar that began around about April. And I'm sorry, I just realized that there's no English month names on the first handout. I didn't prepare this handout for you. I prepared it for my own studies. But the first month is the month Nisan. In March and April, and the seventh month is the month Tishri. And in Judah, they began the year in the month Nisan, roughly April. But in Babylon, they began the year in the month Tishri, September. So often when you're reading the Old Testament, and it talks about years and dates, you have to know which calendar they're working to. And the reason I tell you that is because scholars have said, oh, there are contradictions in the Old Testament. But when you realize that they're using two different calendars, those contradictions melt away. Okay? So, for example, if you don't know this, you can't work out how long the siege of Jerusalem lasted. It looks a lot shorter than it was. Okay? Now, that's all I want to say about the calendars. That's there, as I say, that's for information if ever you decide to study these books. Okay? So, that's chronology. And then the fourth thing, is the area that we're talking about. That's probably the easiest handout, the map. Okay? That's the arena where all these events took place. And if you look at the map, civilization in that period was clustered around the rivers. Okay? You had to be by water to live. And so you have the Nile and the Egyptian civilization down there. And the two great rivers of the Tigris and the Euphrates bounded, if you like, the what's known as Mesopotamia, Assyria and Babylonia. And just as a matter of interest, the Tigris is a faster flowing river because it comes down from the mountains. And the Euphrates is a slower flowing river because it meanders over a fairly flat area. But they merge and they come into the Persian Gulf. And anyway, I could talk for hours about the rivers there, but that's where the civilizations were. So you have Egypt, and you have the Babylonian Empire here, and God put his people in between the two. And that means that the whole history of God's people was affected by these great nations that were around them. They were often under the control of Egypt, and then at other times, under the control of the Assyrians or the Babylonians. And it's interesting, isn't it, that when God's covenant warnings in Deuteronomy came to pass, his people were put into the hands of these nations, particularly the Babylonians. Deuteronomy 28 talks about an enemy ruling over them. And it talks about them being besieged, terrible descriptions of the siege. And then it talks about being exiled, and all of that is in Deuteronomy. And God used these nations, these neighbors, to chastise his people. So this is just sketching the background. So we've talked about the period from Josiah to Nehemiah, 640 to 440. We've talked about the many books of the Old Testament that are affected by all this. We've talked about the problem of chronology briefly and the two calendars. And we've talked about the map and the area. And then the next handout, and I'm going through these pretty quickly, are the empires of Babylon, the empires of Babylon. Well, what you have there is in the early period, and we're only taking this from about 650, so we're ignoring the earlier, someone asked me about Sennacherib, he was too early for this, okay? But the Assyrians were dominant for a long time. But their empire collapsed, and immediately the Neo-Babylonians had their period of power. And then their empire came to an end, and the Medes and the Persians ruled over the area at that time. So that there is a little sketch of the way power changed hands. It came from the Assyrians to the Neo-Babylonians, and it was under the Neo-Babylonians that the people of God were deported. And then came the Medes and the Persians, and it was under the Medes and the Persians that they was brought back. And they lived in exile, okay? So that's there to just give you a rough idea of what's going on. The Assyrian Empire, by the time of our period, the Assyrian Empire was in terminal decline, and Nineveh fell in the year 612. The Neo-Babylonian Empire really began with Nebuchadnezzar's victory at the Battle of Carchemish. That's in a great year, the year 605. And we will come back. Remember that number, 605. We'll come back to that year in a moment, the year 605 BC. Okay? And then you know that the Neo-Babylonian Empire was brought to an end by Cyrus the Persian and, his colleague Darius the Mede, I suppose. But those are the empires that affected our period. And then, right, so those are the introductory points, just sketching out for your help a kind of picture. Stephen. Do you know, that is probably a typo. I'll check it. It'll come up again. Yeah. He definitely wasn't 583. Thank you. He's awake. He's spotted that. The congregation at Emmanuel are used to my typing errors, you know. So. Right. Okay. What I want to do next is I want to give you a history of this period in a nutshell. Okay. I'm trying to sketch. It'll all be worthwhile in the end. Just a sketch of the history. First of all, I want to take you back to Manasseh, King Manasseh. And Manasseh, as you probably know, reigned for 55 years, and he was wicked. He was really wicked. And you can read about him in Chronicles and Kings. But the thing is, Chronicles tells us that Manasseh, in the middle of his reign, was captured by the Assyrians, and he was taken to Babylon. They put a hook in his nose, chains around him, and carted him off to Babylon. Okay, when he was in Babylon, Manasseh repented. He came to his senses, and the amazing thing is that they took him back to Jerusalem. So you have an amazing picture in the life of Manasseh of a man who sinned grievously against the Lord, and yet was chastened and repented and restored. And that's quite amazing, because in the last years of his reign, he started to try to put right the wrongs that he'd done. He became a reforming king. And that's Manasseh. And in one sense, his life is a little bit like a picture of what was coming, the exile and the return. Anyway, we really come and concentrate on King Josiah. Now, King Josiah was a godly man, and we start to come onto the last handout, you'll be glad to know. All right? King Josiah. King Josiah became king at the age of 8 in 640. By the time he was 16, he was seeking the Lord. When he became 20 in the year 628, he started to cleanse, actually implement reform in the land. Now, the year 628, he began his reforms. Almost at the same time, the next year, Jeremiah began his ministry. So just as Josiah was beginning to reform Judah, Jeremiah began prophesying, and he prophesied throughout this a long, long time. Okay? And you know, I'm sure, that in the year 622, the law book was found in the temple. The same year that the law book was found, Ezekiel was born. And about 3 years later, Daniel was born. So I want you to just picture Josiah's reign. You have this young man, from a young age, godly, beginning to seek the Lord. Then as he reached the age of 20, beginning to reform. And so reform is starting, and Jeremiah starts to prophesy. And then the law book is found, and at the same time, Ezekiel is born. And then a couple of years later, Daniel and the three other young men are born. And I just want you to see this scene. In Jerusalem, all this was happening in Jerusalem. You have all these men. Suddenly, God was providing these men. Jeremiah was the senior. He was already ministering, although a young man. And then Ezekiel is given, and Daniel and the three other young men. And all at the time when Josiah is reforming and has found the law. I just want you to get that picture in Jerusalem. Jerusalem today, the old city of Jerusalem, is not a big city. And it was smaller then. You know, these men were walking to the temple together. They were rubbing shoulders. They knew each other. They were, it's like, you know, it's like we are now. These people were together in that time. Okay? Now then, so we've come to Manasseh, come down to Josiah, and this time where God is providing these prophets. And then, right at the end of Josiah's reign, Assyria falls. Assyria, 612, Nineveh is crushed. And what happens is, Nebuchadnezzar rises to power. The year 605, remember, Nebuchadnezzar was a young man. His father was king, but he rose to power in that year, 605. And then if you look at the kings of Judah, Jehoahaz was put on the throne after Josiah, but it's strange. Jehoahaz was 2 years younger than his brothers. For some reason, the people passed over Jehoiakim. But Pharaoh Necho came and said, right, not Jehoahaz. He was deposed. And Jehoiakim was made king. Now, it's under Jehoiakim that the exile really began. We'll come back to that. How many exiles were there? How many deportations were there? Anyone like to tell me? How many?
Two.
It's two. Any advance on two? Three. Someone said four. Someone knows the answer. There were at least four deportations. At least four. You cheat. There were actually more than four, but but the year 605 was the first that we're interested in, 605. Then the ones we know about, 597, 586, and 582. Jeremiah tells us about 582. But the picture was that the Judah, as it were, was being bled of its people bit by bit. They were being taken away stage by stage. And then 7 years later, there were returns. How many returns do we know about? It's not a trick question. Three. Okay, right. We'll stop there. I'll stop you the torture. So that's the snapshot of the history. You have this Manasseh situation. Then you have Josiah the reformer. But then you have Jehoiakim and Zedekiah, absolute decline, wickedness, deportation, exile, and back. That's the snapshot, okay? Right. Now, all I want to do now is give you some little cameos, and I stop. All right? Little snapshots. I want to take you to the year 605. I've talked about this year. I'm trying to fix that date in your minds, the year 605. And I want to tell you what was happening in the life of Nebuchadnezzar. Well, in the summer of 605, Nebuchadnezzar was the crown prince. He wasn't the king. His father was king. But he was out leading the armies of Babylon against the remnant of the Assyrians and the Egyptians. And he attacked Carchemish in the summer of 605. And really, that victory of Nebuchadnezzar at Carchemish, he routed the Egyptian garrison and actually broke Egyptian power over Palestine. Now, from that victory in Carchemish, Carchemish on the map, maybe it's worth seeing it, Carchemish is right at the top. I don't know if you can see that. And Babylon is there. Okay. So Nebuchadnezzar's victory was up here, but Carchemish is down there, and Judah's over here. So it's like an upside-down V shape. Okay. Now, when Nebuchadnezzar defeated, finally, the Egyptians here, he immediately controlled the whole of Palestine. Okay. And he immediately swept down through Palestine, and he besieged Jerusalem. This is the year 605. Okay. Jehoiakim had been on the throne for about three years. And he captured Jehoiakim, and he put him in chains, and he was about to take him off to Babylon. But at that moment, news reached him that his father, Nabopolassar, had died. His father died on the 23rd of August that year. And, or was it the 15th? Anyway, it was very, very quick. Okay? He died, and the news came to him, your father's died. And he knew that he had to get back to Babylon without any delay, because he would have been toppled if he had not reached Babylon. So what he did was he put Jehoiakim back in Jerusalem, left him there, and he took a route almost straight across the desert to Babylon at breakneck speed. And he reached Babylon in astonishingly short time, and he was crowned on the 6th of September. Now, what he did was, before he left Jerusalem, he took certain of the noble young men, and he gave them to his captain, and he told his captain to take them the long route to Babylon. Okay? So Nebuchadnezzar couldn't wait for his captives or anything else, straight to Babylon to be king. But among that group in 605 that went across the long way was Daniel and the three young men. So Daniel and the three young men were taken to Babylon before the real exile began, okay, in the year 605. And they must have arrived there, I guess, about December. That's a guess. But they would have come into the city, and Nebuchadnezzar had just established himself on the throne. Now, that's the year 605. So I want you to see the picture. You have the young Nebuchadnezzar. How old was he? About 21, I guess. And Daniel was probably about 13. And Daniel comes into Babylon, and there's this new empire, this new emperor. And it's really, at this point, that's what happened with Nebuchadnezzar, this remarkable event. It was astonishing that he should do that, but he did. So that's the first cameo. I just want you to see Nebuchadnezzar doing that and claiming the throne, and Daniel coming behind. And then the next little cameo is, we look at Daniel coming into Babylon. And we're in Daniel chapters 1 and 2. And you can see that Daniel, first of all, resolved not to be defiled. I take it that you know what's in chapter 1. He wouldn't defile himself with the king's food. And what you see in the first two chapters of Daniel is that this man and his three friends, but this man particularly, Daniel particularly, was astonishingly honored. It's a remarkable honor that was given to him. In the chapter 2, it says God gave Daniel wisdom, and he revealed secrets to him. And the end of the chapter, which I read to you, is absolutely remarkable. You have Nebuchadnezzar bowing before this young teenager. But I want you to see Daniel absolutely resolved not to be defiled and the way in which God honored him. God answered his prayer, revealed secrets to him, and he was elevated. And the verses I've read are remarkable. Do you see it? He sat in the gate of the king. So that's the second little cameo I want you to see. I want you to see Daniel being refusing, as it were, not to honor God, and himself being lifted up remarkably as a young teenager. And the reason I want you to see this event, these events, is I ask the question, from where did Daniel's resolve come? What was he, 12, 13, 14? We're not absolutely sure. What gave him such absolute resolve? How would you answer that question? What made Daniel the man that he was? I want to suggest to you that, I can prove to you, but I want to suggest to you that, remember that during his childhood in Jerusalem, you're talking about a childhood in Jerusalem, Jeremiah was prophesying. As a child, Daniel would have known Jeremiah and probably heard at least some of his prophecies. He was aware of Jeremiah's ministry. During his childhood, the law of God had been rediscovered. And as you read the book of Daniel, you become aware in the book that Daniel knew Jeremiah and he had his scrolls. He knew the law of God. When he prayed, his prayer is filled with the law of God. If we had more time, we'd look at chapter 9. We haven't got time for that tonight. Right? And what that did was it brought Daniel into a life of prayer. In chapter 6, it's quite clear. From his childhood, he was in the pattern of praying every day. I think three times a day, morning and evening for definite. And he is described in the book as a young person who served God and believed in his heart. This is the picture of Daniel. And I ask the question, Daniel's resolve came out of that heart of faith, but that heart of faith came out of a context where he had the law of God in Jerusalem at that time and Jeremiah the prophet prophesying. So that's the question. I think we must see the connection between Jeremiah and Daniel to see the full picture of this man's childhood. And then I ask the question, if that's where the source of his strength came, what were the after effects? What were the results of having this young man there? Well, first of all, we have, as we saw, the king prostrate before him. It's quite remarkable. I think someone who's about 21 and in power, bowing on the ground before someone who is a teenager and a captive. So, yes, worship indeed, yes. But there were other effects of this God bringing this man to Babylon. Did you notice that he advanced his three friends? One of the things that Daniel did was he used the advantage of his position to promote his friends. You see, it says that in verse 49. He petitioned the king and set Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego over the affairs. Now, it's important you notice that. One of the things Daniel did was promote the other servants of God. And the very fact that he petitioned the king is remarkable. these words, he petitioned the king and sat in the gate of the king, that's remarkable. In those days, you didn't, every Tom, Dick or Harry did not get access to the king. This, you know, you just couldn't breeze into Nebuchadnezzar's palace and put your hand up, excuse me, sir, could I just, would you mind bringing my friends in? That's not what was happening. This is remarkable. God was bringing this man into the, as it were, the gate of the king. And in the gate of the king, he had access to the monarch and he brought his friends in. Now, it's possible that other effects of this, it's possible that Daniel being there, it could be that that's the reason why the temple in Jerusalem was not destroyed in 597. That is speculating, I know. But it's quite possible that Daniel would have been there knowing that Jerusalem was being besieged and attacked. And he prayed every day with his windows open to Jerusalem. He had, like Nehemiah, he had Jerusalem in his heart. And I think it's not unreasonable to think that his presence in Nehemiah's throne room, so to speak, would have been a means by which Jerusalem was spared a little bit longer. Now, Daniel continued in that position of influence right through to the beginning of the reign of Cyrus. It's also possible that his presence there opened the way for Mordecai and Nehemiah. In this period, right through this period, chosen servants of God had access to the monarchs. Right? Daniel definitely had access there. Mordecai was in the gate of the king, exactly the same language. Mordecai sat in the king's gate, and Nehemiah was his cupbearer. In other words, Nehemiah was in his presence. Now, it's not unreasonable to think that there was a chain of influence among these men. So I just want you to sketch it out, and you can chew it over. We have Nebuchadnezzar, whoosh, rising to power. And then God brings Daniel in and says, I want you in the throne room. That's where I want you. 14 years old or not, that's where I want you. And thirdly, the next thing we come to in Daniel is the golden statue. We all know the story of the golden statue and the burning fiery furnace. We know it, don't we? Right, so we can take that for granted. Is it dated? No. We know when Daniel was brought there, 605, 604. The date of the golden statue, we don't know. But we are given certain information about this event. Nebuchadnezzar raised the golden statue and he gathered the leaders of all the provinces to Babylon. Okay? So Nebuchadnezzar, we're told in chapter 3 verse 2 that Nebuchadnezzar summoned the satraps, the governors, the whole administration of the empire. They were all summoned to worship that golden statue. All of them. Now, if that's the case, which it is, among those leaders would have been the king of Judah. Yes, he would have been there. And when we turn to Jeremiah, if you have a Bible, you can just look at this for a moment. If you turn to Jeremiah 51, verse 59, Jeremiah 51 verse 59, we read this: the word which Jeremiah the prophet commanded Sariah, the son of Neriah, the son of Maaseiah, these are the words, when he went with Zedekiah, the king of Judah, to Babylon, in the fourth year of his reign, and so on. And Jeremiah gave him a message. But the fourth year of his reign would have been 593 BC. So in the summer, or in that year of 593, Zedekiah was summoned to Babylon. Now, it's not like taking the bus to London, okay? It wasn't a 5-minute holiday. For him to go to Babylon with his entourage was a big deal. It wasn't something you did every year, okay? So this was an unusual event. And I think that just before that, there had been a revolt in the army of Nebuchadnezzar. So in Babylon, they had this situation where Nebuchadnezzar had been under threat as the king. And he crushed that revolt in the army. And I think then he summoned all his leaders, and the statue, effectively, was to reclaim their allegiance. And of course, I think Zedekiah was probably the man, and he would have been in there. Now the point of this is this, that when the three young men stood up and said, "We will not bow before your statue," they were probably looking down on the king of Judah bowing before the statue. It just adds a bit of intensity and color. Those three young men were standing up when the leaders that they respected were bowing down. You can see the connection between Jeremiah and Daniel 3. The golden statue, they're summoned there, and they all bow down, but not these three believers. Okay, I just press on. And then, so we've looked at Nebuchadnezzar, Daniel, and that event. Fourthly, fourth cameo is Ezekiel's life. Ezekiel was born in the year 622 BC when the law book was found. He was carried away to Babylon in the first main deportation. And he began to prophesy when he was 30 years old. He ended his prophecy when he was 50. So in other words, he prophesied exactly in the period of time that a priest would be mainly active, from 30 to 50. And during the time when he began to prophesy, it was exactly the next year when Zedekiah rebelled. So Ezekiel was among the captives, and he began to prophesy when Zedekiah the king rebelled against Babylon. Now, the next year, Nebuchadnezzar began to besiege the city, and after a long siege, on the 18th of July, 586, the city fell, and that was followed by the destruction of the temple and the walls. So you have Ezekiel. If you read the book of Ezekiel, it's in three parts. You have this period leading up to the destruction of the temple, those bitter years. And in the middle, then he addresses the nations. And then afterwards, he gives them words of comfort. But does anyone know what happened on the time when the temple was destroyed? Does anyone know what happened in Ezekiel's life? Almost the day that the temple was destroyed, that day the Lord spoke to Ezekiel. And do you know what he said to him? Anyone know? "Today, your wife is going to be taken from you." And the Lord took Ezekiel. His wife died that day. Ezekiel was about 34 years old. So at the age of about 34, his wife was taken. And the Lord said to Ezekiel, he said, "You're not to mourn. You're not to mourn." Why not? It's a lesson to God's people. The delight, their delight is being taken from them, and they are not mourning. So when Ezekiel's wife died, it was a symbol of the temple being destroyed, Jerusalem being destroyed, And so he was there in Babylon. That was going on in Judah. And his wife dies, and the people said, why aren't you mourning? Your wife's just died. I don't know how old he was when he married, but you know, he's a young man. He said, because you're not mourning over the temple. And but what's so astonishing to me, anyway, all Ezekiel's prophecies are dated quite accurately, by the way. So when the temple fell, he lost his wife, that message. And I think, you know, when I think of the experience of the prophets, Jeremiah went through a terribly hard ministry. But Ezekiel had his trials as well, for his wife to be taken from him as part of his ministry. Anyway, but as soon as the temple fell, within a year, Ezekiel begins to prophesy of the glory of the future temple. And for me, it's remarkable that God immediately begins to comfort his people with a vision, not only of Jerusalem restored, but of the great glory of the temple at the end, you know. So that's what you get there, the eschatological glory. Nebuzaradan, the captain of Nebuchadnezzar's army, he systematically destroyed Jerusalem and the temple in August of 586. And in 585, the next year, Ezekiel began to prophesy of its restoration. And right, I want to ask a question. I'm nearly at the end. Earlier on, I spoke to you about Manasseh's repentance and Josiah's reform. But Josiah's reforms almost filled his reign, nearly 40 years. And I wanted to ask the question, why do you think that Manasseh's repentance and Josiah's reform was not enough to save God's people from exile? Why wasn't it enough to spare them the temple being destroyed and Jerusalem being destroyed? Why not? Josiah reformed the land. He took away the idols. He opened up the temple. He brought the law back. They kept the Passover. Why weren't they spared? I don't have an answer. I thought someone might have had an answer this evening, but Kevin's got an answer.
Wrong answer. I wonder whether Jeremiah was really that impressed with the reforms. Outwardly there was reform, but the inward heart of the people just rebelled.
I think that's the only answer I could come up with. And it makes you can I say it like this and you can shoot me down? Reformation without revival is no good. Is that a dangerous statement to make? You can reform everything, get all the order right and all the rest of it. If the heart's not right, it's not right. And I think that's what's going on there. The king comes and says, right, we're getting rid of all those idols. And they get rid of all those idols, but the people wanted them. And God knew that. He said, no, you're not right yet. Stephen, you got another answer.
This was a long-term problem that had gone over a long period of time where the people of Judah had gone more and more in the center and more away from God. And I may be wrong, but I think before the good things that did happen, God had already decided they were going to exile. Does the scripture not indicate that?
Well, do you know, what you're saying I think is correct. And I think why it's so interesting, to me anyway, why it's so interesting to me is this, that in a situation where, if you like, the judgment had already been pronounced, what God was actually doing was preparing servants of his in that breathing space who were going to serve him right through the exile and into the return. And I think that's the way these things fit together. I think that, God had decided before, Manasseh's reign, this is the end. They are going to be exiled. The covenant judgment is coming. And yet you have a breathing space. And you have all these men, Jeremiah, Ezekiel, Daniel, even Josiah himself, being, as it were, raised up, and they weren't successful immediately in stemming the tide. But they were carried away, and they did lay the ground for future recovery, and obviously, eventually, for the coming of the Messiah. And if I can just speculate a little bit more, if Daniel and his access to the king was able to bring his three friends forward, if later that paved the way for Mordecai, right? Mordecai was able to, as it were, guide Esther, and between them, the whole destruction of Judah was saved. And we know that behind that is Satan's attack on Christ. Just as, you know, in previous generations, Pharaoh and the midwives and all the rest of it, right through biblical history, you have these attempts of the devil to destroy the line from which Christ is going to be born. And I think you picture Daniel as a young man listening to Jeremiah. The king has found the law book. And without him realizing it, being prepared as an instrument of God, which was one day going to, if you like, a means to which would bring Christ to us. And I think those are some of the connections that I wanted I want to draw out some lessons, and I'll stop. By the way, how old was Daniel when he was thrown into the den of lions? Roughly.
80,
yeah. And you see pictures, don't you, of a young man sitting in the den of lions. Forget it, he was 80 plus. So, right. Just some thoughts then on perhaps lessons. First of all, when Daniel was taken into exile in the year 605, you might be tempted to think that that was a terrible thing to happen to him in his life. You might say, what an awful thing for this young man to be taken away from the city he loved. Actually, it was a great mercy of God to him. He was taken away before the sieges and before the deportations. So he was actually spared. Jeremiah was left there during all that. And boy, Jeremiah suffered a lot more than Daniel. And I think it just reminds us that for each of us who are ministers, particularly, God has different plans for us. Do you know? For one of us, he might give great congregations and many converts, and for others, an entirely different path of life. And we just have to accept that he uses each one of us in ways that please him. You can debate in your own mind whether Jeremiah or Daniel was the most successful, in light of what I just said. But either way, we know that God is dealing with one way. You know, one is beheaded, the other is set free from prison. Isn't it? That's what's going on, you know. And then secondly, when you think about Daniel, I think we have to recognize that great service depends on great piety. And unless we are nurturing our souls, right, we can forget about serving God with distinction, can't we? You know, isn't it true that it's in the faith that is in us and in the burning zeal, it's what God is doing in us. If he creates, as it were, that piety, it's out of that that we will serve him. And if that's not there, then we shouldn't expect anything. Am I right? You know, Daniel's piety, the foundations of Daniel's piety was laid in the law and in prophecy and prayer before he was 12. As a child, he was nurtured on these things. And a lifetime of distinguished service arose out of that childhood. And I think we need to think about that. And a third thought on this is how God's people affect one another. We affect each other. Jeremiah affected Daniel, and Daniel affected the three young men, and probably others to come. Our piety will impact on one another, as our disobedience will. And even if we've never met One of the things you see in the period of the exile is that God's children, saints who had never met each other, nevertheless, one had affected the other. Over this period of 200 years, the foundations in Jeremiah were bearing fruit in the life of Esther and Nehemiah and others. Another fourth application, if you like, is the covenant dealings of God. As you study this period, you learn about the covenant dealings of God. And then the fifth, I've already mentioned, the danger to the line of Christ. Throughout the history of the Old Testament, we see these moments when the line of the Messiah is almost extinguished. It's preserved on a thread. And we have it in this period. Well, I can see that my time is... Have I got time for one more moment? Where's the permission from the chairman? But I have one more minute. I can't read this to you tonight, but if you read Jeremiah 40 to 44... It's right at the end of, right at the end of the exile, the deportation period, and Jeremiah is taken to Egypt, right? He didn't want to go to Egypt. He wanted to stay in Jerusalem. But there's two things I want you, if you go back and read these chapters, there's two things I'd like you to take home. One is, the people came to Jeremiah and said, should we stay in Jerusalem or should we run away to Egypt? That was the question. And Jeremiah said to them, this is the word of the Lord for you. If you stay in Jerusalem, you will be safe. The Babylonians will not hurt you. They will look after you. And do you know what they did? They said, you're a false prophet. You're telling us lies. And down to Egypt they went. You have this astonishing thing that after all that vindication of Jeremiah's prophecy, they still wouldn't listen. And they took him to Egypt with them. Well, what did they do when they got to Egypt? Well, Jeremiah starts rebuking them for their idolatry. They were worshipping idols in Egypt. But the thing is, he spoke to the men, right? You'll see this in Jeremiah 44, 43, 44. He spoke to the men. He said, you mustn't do this. Some of them knew that their wives were doing it in secret. And because they knew that their wives were worshipping idols in secret, they wouldn't accept Jeremiah's warnings. And they became his enemies. And it's just a little indication of how some men can be incredibly weak because they're swayed by the sins of their wives. And you get this in Jeremiah. Sorry, ladies, this is not directed at you. It's actually directed, men must be men and not give in to their wicked wives. I think this might be the last, the last time I'm speaking to you.
Thank you, Peter.
I'd stop.
We have, say, 2 minutes of questions and they're really pressing.
King Cyrus is called anointed.
Yes.
Brief comment. Wasn't
he? Cyrus, my shepherd. Yeah. Yeah, God uses Trump and and Theresa May and others too, yeah. Yeah. Amazing. Is that it? No, come on.
How old was Daniel when he died?
We don't know. It just says he continued until the first year of Darius or Cyrus, whichever one it is there.
And it says Daniel prospered during the reign of Darius.
That's right.
And the reign of Cyrus.
That's right. So he probably went on for, yeah.
Just in your date here.
What have I got?
Darius was from 520 to 486. So he would have been very old then.
That's a different Darius.
Okay.
Don't be fooled by the Dariuses. There's more than one of them. I can't explain that now. That would take another hour and I haven't got it. Okay. Is that it? Yes. Right, thank you very much and I hope it wasn't too confusing.